Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. One big food holiday down, a few more to go. Rather than taking up an exercising hobby, get into canning. I'll tell you how today. And since it's a big day for leftovers, I'm serving up some of my favorites for this week's show. Padma Lakshmi on bold flavors, the history of the toothpick, the 5-second rule, believe it at your peril, and living biblically, literally. First, a fresh look at this week's Farmer's Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Chris Schubert sells walnuts for Rancho La Vina, which is a beautiful walnut ranch up near Santa Barbara. If you have seen the movie Sideways, this is where they had that picnic in the walnut orchard. And Chris is here on Wednesdays at the Santa Monica Market. You've got wonderful walnut oil, fresh walnuts, toasted walnuts. And can you tell us, first of all, why is it that your walnut's here, and why is a fresh walnut so much better than another kind of walnut?
Part of it is that we grow coastal planes, premium coastal planes, and our location, which is about 12 miles from the Pacific Ocean, gets very cool in the evenings. We get fog in there. It tends to dissipate a lot of the acidity out of the walnut, so it makes them very sweet. We get a little longer hang time, so while other people are pulling their crops, sometimes up to a month before we do, we let them hang longer. They develop more flavor, get a much higher flavor profile.
And now, these are older trees? Has this orchard been here for a while?
The ranch was established in 1869. It's an old Spanish land grant. It's about 2,800 acres, 185 of that planted to walnuts. Some of the trees are getting close to 100 years old. They start to slow down after they get to be about 100, 125, like we all do.
Yeah, right. And that's a white meat walnut?
Yes.
One of those white ones?
Yeah, it's actually an English walnut.
Now, these ones you have here today on your table, were they harvested this year, this past fall?
These were harvested last year, so our new walnuts don't actually come to the market till about between Christmas and New Year's.
All right, and then these are kept in storage, and they always taste super fresh to me.
Yeah, cold storage, and we tend to crack them a couple times a year, which helps a lot, because a little walnut in its shell is like a little anaerobic facility in itself, so there's no oxygen coming in there, and until they actually fall on the ground and get wet, they don't think they're going to be trees, so they'll hang out. They have built-in little enzyme inhibitors in them so that they don't sprout.
Okay. This is why they taste so fresh.
That's got a lot to do with it.
All right. And now tell us a little bit about the walnut oil, too. You press this. It's super, super delicate. Now, this is not a cooking oil, right?
Well, actually, it is a cooking oil. Oh. It tends to be almost a replacement for olive oil, or somewhere between a flaxseed and an olive oil, because it's loaded with omega-3s and 6s, just like the walnuts. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we toast the same walnuts that come from the orchard first. After toasting, we cold press them, just like you would an olive oil. And then from that, we add absolutely nothing else to it. It just goes through a stainless steel filter and straight into the can.
Can you give us a recipe that you like to use at home, either using the walnuts or the oil or both?
For the oil, probably the most popular thing to do is salad dressing. So the classic French way to do it would be a little bit of lemon juice, the walnut oil, and the smallest piece of garlic you can imagine, a quarter of a clove. And some people will whisk in maybe a dime-sized piece of gorgonzola for salad dressing, or balsamic and walnut oil. Classic way to do salad dressing.
All right, and these are going to be great for the holidays. All your baking, all your cooking, all your pancake breakfast, this is where to get them. That was Chris Schubert, who works with Rancho La Vina, the wonderful land-grant ranch up near Santa Barbara. He's got walnuts and walnut oil at many markets down here in Los Angeles. And the walnut oil is a wonderful gourmet thing you can try at home to really spice up your cooking. Avocados are back in season. They were out briefly. There's a time of the year when they go away, and now they're back. And Laura Ramirez of JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch from Redlands is here at the Wednesday Market, and she's got some very interesting pomegranates that don't stain. So let's talk first about these wonderful pomegranates, and then we'll get back into the avocados. Talk to us about these pink pomegranates.
Oh, they're so wonderful. I love these because they're pink inside. They have a very soft seed, so they're not really hard like the wonderfuls are. And they're not as acidic, so people who have some stomach problems will really love them. I've always loved them all my life. You can just eat them with salads, and you can really blend them, and the seed doesn't bother you after you've blended it in the blender, so it's wonderful.
The best way to peel a pomegranate, these are not going to stain you the minute they jump out and stain your favorite shirt, but how do you recommend peeling one of these pomegranates?
Well, I heard on the food channel, let's see, that you can cut it in half and you can hit it on the back with a wooden spoon. But the way I do it, and they're supposed to pop right out. But some people pull them apart underwater, and that's supposed to be a great thing, and then they'll float up to the top. Or what I do is I cut the top, the little top that has looks like a little flower out, and then I score it in four sections, and it actually comes out very well. Don't cut it all the way through. Score it on the top and pull it back, and it'll come out nicely for you.
Oh, okay, great. Well, good things to try at home then with those pomegranates. Okay, and then now your avocados are coming back. You've got several varieties. What have you got right now?
I do. Right now we have something called a seedling, which is very nice. It's not too watery. A lot of people think that the green skins aren't very flavorful, but this one is very flavorful, and it has enough oil content so that it tastes really nicely. And I also have something called a Jim Bacon, which is very good too. And I have a bacon, which is going to be very sweet and very flavorful. It's a little lighter, but it's very nice in a salad. It's all these green skins. Everybody thinks that they should only have Hass, but if they come by my stand, I'll make sure that they have a little taste of whatever they have any kind of question about.
Okay, and when you say green skin, these are an earlier variety than that nice black, that pebbly black Hass that we all love so much. These just come out earlier in the year.
They come out earlier in the year, but they are through the season with Hass also. So all of them have their own seasons. I'd recommend right now, this time of year, using the Fuerte. It's one of the more traditional avocados that people overlook.
And that's a green skin, too.
Also.
Okay. Now, when is the Hass coming out?
Hass should be coming out at the end of December, the beginning of January.
Well, good, Laura. It's good to talk to you and catch up and try some of these different avocado varieties. And we love the non-staining pomegranates.
Yummy.
Yummy. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Information and pictures of the things Laura Avery talked about are at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've ever seen Top Chef, you may have noticed the raving beauty that's the host. She's Padma Lakshmi, herself an accomplished cookbook author. She stops by Good Food next to talk about what she actually eats when she's hanging out at home, plus how the foods of the Mediterranean and Asia are actually quite similar. That's coming up next on Good Food. Padma Lakshmi's a triple threat, a natural beauty whose time spent modeling gave her a chance to travel and broaden her palette. She's also an actress, noted TV celebrity with Top Chef under her belt, but it's her skill as a cook and a cookbook author that interests us today. I'd really love to welcome you to Good Food, Padma.
Thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Well, so. I have to tell you that your ease in describing your sort of culinary journey and your taste journey throughout your life, which is so interesting because it's very modern. So why don't we talk a little bit about your connection to L.A. to begin with? I understand that you actually lived here for a time.
I did. I went to high school here.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Workman High School in West Covina. Then I lived here again as an adult. You know, I love Los Angeles because it has so many, like New York City, it has so many ethnicities.
Now, you grew up the only child with a single mom, as I am too. And I know what it's like to bond with your mom over the stove.
Yeah. I mean, I really learned at her elbow. And she was a very busy woman. She worked. She was the head nurse of radiation therapy at this very major cancer institute. She was going to school at night. And my mother always was famous in our family to be able to whip something up in half an hour or less. And then I learned from my Peruvian babysitter. And then I learned from, you know, the grandma of my Filipino playmates. And then, you know, on and on and on.
During this intense global growing up that you had, what were some of the flavor threads that ran through it and which are your comfort flavors?
I would say, you know, if I had to describe my cooking, it's really a combination of Mediterranean and Asian foods. I spent 6 years in Italy, and I really got a very rigorous training in classic European cooking technique there. But my flavor, you know, like, it, you know, if we think about what flavors I reach for the most, they're often South American or Asian. If you look at those two cultures, Latin America and Asia, they're on opposite sides of the globe. But so many ingredients appear in both. Tamarind, chilies, tomatoes, cilantro, cumin, mangoes, coconuts. And so when you look at it from a more macro point of view, we really have much more in common with each other than we realize. And so if you can start to understand that, you can really almost trace a history of a people through its food. Like if you look at Spain, 1492, very important year. Killer year for Spain, right? You have Isabel and Ferdinand hooking up. You have the Jews being expelled. You have the Moors coming up. And, you know, this town of Granada named after the pomegranate.
Don't you love that?
You know, paella is just biryani brought over by Muslims. That's all it is. Nasi goreng, which is an Indonesian fried rice dish. What is it? Rice pilaf, again. So you have risotto. Again, so the way I believe that, you know, a culture has a culinary history, this is my culinary history. This is really a culinary scrapbook of my life.
You have that great sauce that's a combination of the date chutney and the chipotle chilies. I love that.
Yeah, Francesco Clemente's amazing hot sauce. He loves that sauce. So he begged me to name it after him. Obviously, I was charmed to do so. That is so easy. You know, it's based on a chutney, but I use chipotle peppers and adobo sauce because I just love the piquancy of it. And I use them because they're so hot. Garlic, honey, salt, tomatoes, and dates. That's it. You just whiz it all in a blender. I was making this stuff. Every time I make a batch, all my friends want it. So I kept making it hotter and hotter so that they'd use smaller and smaller portions of it. Because otherwise,
All
I was doing was making chutney. And I'd be happy to do that if anyone with a big company is listening. But, you know, like at the end of the day, I have other jobs, you know. And
that was the other thing I was going to ask you. You obviously have cooked on your own for a very long time. You're a very sure hand in the kitchen. All those years modeling and now being on television as you are, part of this search for flavor must be a way to satisfy yourself without fat.
It's very easy to reach for a stick of butter. You know, I love food, but I am a very vain person. And, I want to look nice. I wanted to still fit into all those clothes that I've accumulated over the years. And so I really believe in flavor. I believe in clean, pure, intense flavor and not too many warring flavors on the palate. It's important to curate those flavors. The reason there are a lot of ingredients in Indian spice blends is because some of them you're not supposed to even taste, but they buffer your stomach, like fenugreek. Fenugreek buffers your stomach. It has an aroma to it, but it's really there to balance all those heat-inducing cloves and cardamom.
The experience of being involved with Top Chef, did it solidify your desire for simplicity and clarity?
Yes. I have to tell you, I eat every single item that is made on that show. I go into food detox after Top Chef. I don't want to eat anything but like chicken broth and salads. Often I'm tasting a dish which has 12 ingredients, and then I'm tasting 16 dishes with at least a dozen ingredients in each of them. So people always ask me, like, what makes, you know, the show? And I say, well, I don't know what makes the show, but I do know that the whole show hinges on my digestive tract. And luckily I have a stomach of steel, touch wood.
It has been such a pleasure meeting you and having this conversation. Thank you, Padma.
Thanks for having me. Support NPR. Give them lots of money.
That was Padma Lakshmi. Her new book is Tangy Tart Hot and Sweet, and it is really quite marvelous. I've got a recipe for Padma's chutney online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Amy Sedaris was the actress and writer behind the disturbingly funny Comedy Central series Strangers with Candy. She's also a playwright and, of course, is the sister of the equally talented David Sedaris. It may surprise you to know that Amy Sedaris is a natural party giver. Even living with an imaginary boyfriend named Ricky, she manages to find the time to bake cupcakes and create interesting dinner parties. Her new book is a wacky and unorthodox take on home entertaining. Next, entertaining advice from one of the most original people on the planet. That's when Good Food returns. Thank you. may know her best as Jerry Blank in the television series Strangers with Candy, but to call Sedaris an actress or even a comedian is to shortchange her. A constantly changing performance artist may be more like it. So why is she on Good Food? Well, her new book on entertaining called I Like You is probably one of the most truthful books on the subject I've ever read. And reading truth about cooking and entertaining while laughing too much is, well, that's a great thing.
That's good.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Believe me, it's our pleasure. So have you always enjoyed entertaining?
I've always enjoyed entertaining, and I do cook. I cook a lot.
We should say, first of all, the book is extremely visual, and it's sort of like a scrapbook of the inside of your mind, which has to be a very interesting thing.
Disturbing. Disturbing.
You seem to spend a lot of time
alone.
So that when you do choose to have people enter your world, you're very concerned with putting them at ease and giving them a lot of things to do so they won't get bored.
Yes, that's very important. You don't see any wires in my apartment. You don't see a TV. You don't see a stereo. You don't see the phone or hear it. So it's like a psychiatrist's office. You know, have a fake fireplace, you know, a little rabbit hopping around. Who doesn't like rabbits, right? So, you're very much at ease in my apartment.
I would imagine that one of the things you really must do in a very interesting way is deciding who to bring in and who to put together. How do you decide on a mix? What sort of mixes of
people? Do you smoke pot or do you not smoke pot? Let's start there. You know what I mean? No, you do have to think about that. Yeah, it's all about who you cast.
So do the holidays, Halloween and Thanksgiving, have particular meaning for you as crafty as you are?
I like them. I like the fall. That's my favorite season. I was just lucky enough to be in Asheville, North Carolina for Peak Week.
And what is that?
Peak Week is right the peak of when all the trees are changing. They were on fire. So I thought, oh, great. You know, I have an iron. I just need to go buy some wax paper. I'm going to iron my leaves between wax paper, which I hang up in my apartment every fall.
What happens to a leaf when you iron it between wax paper?
It sticks to the wax, you know, that's on the paper. So it's just pressed. And then so when you hang it up in a window, the light comes through it and you just see the leaves. And it looks like it's in a frosty background because of the wax paper.
See, I love that because when I was a kid, we used to make our own wrapping paper, and we did it by shaving crayons in between two sheets of wax paper and then ironing.
Oh, you did not?
Yeah.
Really? I can do that in my hotel room. Great. Room service is going to see. Oh, really? That's a good idea.
And speaking of irons, is it really true that you taught Martha Stewart how to...
Yeah, iron a grilled cheese sandwich. I mean,
When she was in prison?
Well, it was way before prison, you know, and we were doing Conan O'Brien together, and I asked them, I said, what is she going to be doing? And they said, she's going to teach Conan how to iron a shirt. And I said, okay, I'll teach him, you know, how to iron a cheese sandwich. You know, she ever goes to prison. And so that's what I did.
And did she end up using that knowledge?
I don't know. I didn't ask her. I bet she didn't. Can you imagine? BLT next. Can you imagine?
Now, every once in a while, actual real horrible life intrudes. Is there anything you can do with pets to sort of enhance the grieving process?
Oh, well, if it's a small pet, I make these little bags out of felt, grieving sacks. Anyway, you make these felt bags, and then you can put the ashes in it, and then you can do a felt cutout of the animals. So let's say you lost a mouse. It'd be a little cutout of a little mouse on the felt, and you put little ashes in there of your mouse.
But you still have you have a newer rabbit, a rabbit who isn't ashes. You have a catering company that you've named after Dusty.
Well, when I got my first rabbit, I said, you young lady, if you're going to live here, you're going to have to get a job. So I came up with my cupcake business. And so I sell my cupcakes, and I still do. And all that money goes into a jar, which is my allowance. And then for Dusty, she was living off that money. So I said, you've got to come up with another job. So that's when I started making cheese balls.
This isn't a joke. You actually really, really make cupcakes and cheese balls.
Out of my apartment, yeah. It's just something to do. It's a job. I can complain about butter. I can complain about the price of vanilla. And I can always say I have a job.
Who are your customers?
Oh, I'm a very busy woman. I mean, I'm a very, very busy woman. Gourmet Garage now makes my cheese balls for me. So when I make them at home now, it's usually a special order, people who I've known for a while. And then for cupcakes, I make them whenever I want, and I just walk them right over and sell them at a coffee shop in my neighborhood.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about your cheese balls. What makes them special?
It's smoked Gouda, cream cheese, butter, steak at one's house, a little bit of milk, and you form a ball, and you roll it in crushed nuts. And you spread it on a Ritz cracker. But it has to be a Ritz.
But I know you're Greek.
Yeah, Greek. There's a lot of Greek food in the book.
There's a lot of Greek food in the book. But there's one recipe I've always seen and I've tasted places and I've been afraid to make it. But now that I saw it in your book, that fear is gone. And that's the, what is it, Galacta Borrego?
Oh, yeah, it's the milk pie.
Yeah,
it's
the milk
easy.
Pie.
It's just working with phyllo. And just it, all it is like, you know, when you make like a pudding, you know what I mean? And then you pour it into the phyllo little shell that you made. It's really simple. I love it. But that's a good thing to make for anybody, anything with phyllo, because people are intimidated by it. Like I am with egg whites. I can't – anything that says fold or peak, I freak out about. I'm just not good with egg whites, you know.
Oh, look what I just turned to here.
The baked Alaska.
Oh, that's a baked Alaska.
Yeah, see, that's egg whites, but I know how to make – I can make that because that was a cake I had my mom make when I was growing up.
Describe to us the elements of a baked Alaska for those poor unfortunates who have never had one.
Well, the bottom of it is like you make a sponge cake, and then you put ice cream in some kind of mold or bowl, cover it with saran wrap, chill it. And then when you take it out, you flip it upside down, so it's a dome, and you put it the dome of ice cream on top of the sponge cake or brownie, and then you make a, what do you call it?
Meringue.
A meringue, and then you put it all over the cake, and then you burn it. You brown it on top with a torch, or you put it under your broiler. Did I describe that very well?
You described it perfectly.
That's my
and I
dessert.
Just imagine the faces of people at your house who probably the last thing they expect you to serve them is a baked Alaska.
Well, I let them do it. They enjoy it. They like the torch. I make them wear the goggles, you know, and I love it when people are good at it. It's like the marshmallow when you're making, you know, bringing a marshmallow and you just want it black and on fire. I like stuff like that.
God, you're great.
Well, I mean, you know.
The next time I'm in New York, I have to come over.
Oh, my God. Bring roach spray.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, thank you. I didn't know you had a restaurant. That's so great. That's a full-time job.
I like you. Hospitality Under the Influence is Amy Sedaris' book on entertaining. It's just been released on paperback, and even if you never plan cooking from it, read it just to laugh out loud at the stories and photos. Do you subscribe to the 5-second rule, where a food that drops on the ground is still okay to eat as long as it's been there for less than 5 seconds? Well, of course, someone has actually done the research on whether 5 seconds makes any difference at all. The results are next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Believe the notion that if something touches the floor for less than 5 seconds, it's still clean and safe to eat. But is this 5-second rule true? Noted food scientist Hal McGee is here to tell us. Has this actually been researched?
Actually, it has. To my great surprise, I came across a paper this year from Clemson University testing the 5-second rule using little squares of bologna and different sorts of flooring that had been sprayed with bacteria just to see whether the bologna would pick up the bacteria.
Well, first of all, I think the use of bologna is bologna. Because bologna is this like viscous, sticky substance. It's a lot different than a cookie that has all these crags and craters and less surface area to interact with the floor.
No, that's a really good point. And they actually did try crackers as well and found that the level of contamination on crackers was lower. But what you want to know is the worst case scenario, right? Because you never know. It might be a slice of pizza that's still kind of sticky, and that would be even worse than
bologna. That's right. Hit me where it hurts. Okay, so what did they say? How bad is it?
It's a mixed bag, really, because what they did was they put a lot of bacteria on these various kinds of flooring. It was tile, wood, and carpeting.
What kinds of bacteria did they use?
They used Salmonella.
Now, is that what we would find on our floors?
It's going to depend on the surface. And, this applies not just to floors. It's any kind of surface that could have something else on it that you don't want in your mouth.
The bologna, I would expect, picked up a lot of salmonella.
Yes. Well, the first interesting finding was how long those bacteria can survive on surfaces. If you spray some bacteria on a surface and leave it until it dries, I thought that the drying would kill most of the bacteria. And in fact, what they found was that 24 hours after laying down the bacteria, thousands of them per square centimeter were still alive. And especially on the carpeting, which has, lots of little nooks and crannies where things can find a little microclimate. And they actually did the experiment and left the bacteria for 28 days and found that there were still hundreds per square centimeter surviving.
But what I'm wondering is, if this really comes close to what most people's kitchen floors are like.
Yeah, it's a much more complicated picture on a real surface. And an intern at the University of Illinois, she did a survey of floors and found that they were remarkably clean. Now, this is in an institution where, people come in and clean the floors every few days. And I don't know how well that reflects an ordinary household either. So it's probably somewhere in between.
After you read this, did your behavior regarding the 5-second rule change?
I don't count to five and then time myself. But yeah, you do a kind of calculation. You drop something and you kind of think about it. How valuable is this to me? How's my floor looking?
When was the last time I cleaned it? How much animal hair is attached to the item?
That's right. On a rainy day, has someone just walked through with muddy boots? All kinds of things that your brain sort of takes into account when it makes a decision like that. So I wouldn't say it's changed much. I just do think about it more often. And another point that I wanted to find out, how many bacteria does it take to make you sick? And it turns out that the answer is not very many, somewhere between 10 and 100 for salmonella and for E. coli. So when the numbers are small like that, those things can be pretty nasty. I think that's a reason to redefine the 5-second rule. My suggestion is that you take 5 seconds to remember that there are lots of bacteria around and that bologna picks up a lot of it, and then take as long as you need to make that mental calculation. How much do I really need this piece of food?
It makes me afraid for people that are already very concerned about germs. I mean, don't we need our immune systems to sort of fight bacteria in order to be strong?
I can remember someone proposing what they called the hygienic hypothesis, which was that the increase that we were seeing in allergies and asthma and things like that in kids was the result of a hyper-clean environment. And that theory 25 years ago was not widely accepted, but it has come to be accepted. And the thing is that it's probably a good idea for children whose immune systems are developing to be exposed to all kinds of things. But it's a different story if you're an adult and if you've already gone through that formative stage and you've either got resistance or you don't, and then to expose yourself unnecessarily, that is something to give one pause.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Evan.
Harold McGee is one of the nation's most noted food scientists. His books on food and cooking and The Curious Cook remain important reference materials for the food industry. I've got a link to his website on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. So are there such things as good calories and bad ones? Remember the Atkins diet? Lots of animal proteins and fats and no carbs? Well, my next guest is bringing it back. He's a correspondent for Science Magazine, and he's been getting a lot of criticism. That's next on Good Food. What if everything we've been told about the benefits of a low-fat, high-carb diet were wrong? What if all the science which underpins this juggernaut of an idea was created by ignoring good science that didn't fit the theory? Gary Taubes is an award-winning science journalist who spent 5 years writing Good Calories, Bad Calories, a densely researched exploration of the low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Evan.
Let's start with an explanation of, I guess you call it in your book, Endocrinology 101, the connection between refined carbohydrates, insulin, and weight gain.
Okay. Although before I do that, I'm going to explain thermodynamics 101. For the past 50 years, we have believed that weight gain and obesity is determined by the difference between the calories you consume and the calories you expend. This is why public health authorities and nutritionists and your next door neighbor is always telling you it's about calories in versus calories out. And there are numerous problems with this, the first of them being that it's sort of a meaningless statement. Certainly, if you get fat, you will consume more calories than you expend, but that doesn't mean that you get fat because you consume more calories than you expend. Okay? Overeating can be caused by some underlying physiological phenomenon, in which case you would overeat perhaps because you're getting fat and not vice versa. Okay? So now we get to endocrinology 101. Endocrinology is a study of hormones. And as it turns out, fat tissue, like every other tissue and organ in our body, is very carefully regulated. And what regulates it are hormones, you know, insulin, adrenaline, growth hormones, steroids, all these different hormones basically function to keep us living on a day-to-day basis regardless of what's happening in the outside world. And in the late 1950s, early 1960s, researchers discovered what it is that regulates the amount of fat we carry. And as it turns out, that is regulated almost exclusively by insulin. The hormone insulin puts calories in our fat tissue. And as it turns out, we secrete insulin in response to the carbohydrates in our diet. So if you believe in the sort of biology of living organisms as opposed to the kind of overly simplistic physics that we hear all the time, then you would think that carbohydrates make us fat. Bread, potatoes, pasta, rice, sodas, beer, sweets, all the things that our parents grew up believing really did make us fat.
But then all of a sudden there's this shift where we're being told everywhere that the cause of heart disease is excess fat and that dietary fat causes the rise in cholesterol, which causes this epidemic of heart disease.
Well, and this is what happens. In the late 50s, some very charismatic, ambitious zealots, in effect, I mean, it's a stretch to call them scientists, but a group of men came to believe that fat was the cause of heart disease. And what we have to realize, a low-fat diet, you know, fat is a cause of heart disease, and you're supposed to eat a low-fat diet. And a low-fat diet is, by definition, a high-carbohydrate diet. What you do is you replace some of the fat in the diet with more carbohydrates. So through the 60s and into the 70s, this faith in the curing powers of a low-fat diet got more and more support. It became more and more of the medical dogma. And as a result, you couldn't say that carbohydrates make you fat because you're busy saying that fat causes heart disease. And these two belief systems clashed. And the fattening carbohydrate was just kind of thrown out. It was inconvenient. We can't believe it. And therefore, we're going to pay no attention to it. And it's fascinating. Through the 1970s, you could just watch it vanish from the literature as though suddenly to say that carbohydrates make you fat, which had been conventional wisdom, is to be accused of quackery.
Talk to me a little bit about what heart surgeons, people who open us up and look at our veins, think about cholesterol and the idea that dietary cholesterol is what causes heart disease.
The idea that dietary cholesterol would cause elevations in blood levels of cholesterol was kind of adopted because it made for a simpler story. You could tell people that all cholesterol is bad, and they don't have to really differentiate between what's the cholesterol in the diet and what's the cholesterol in the blood. Many of the decisions that were made over the past 50 years, many of the beliefs that got integrated into this public health advice were based on trying to make complicated things seem simple enough so that any American can understand them. So we should believe, for instance, that all fat is bad and eat low-fat diets, because there was a period where people thought it was too complicated to tell people that saturated fats are the ones that raise cholesterol. And even saturated fats only raise cholesterol in comparison to other foods. So, you know, saturated fats raise cholesterol compared to monounsaturated fats or compared to carbohydrates. One of the ones I find most amazing is if you look at meat. We tend to think of, you know, meat is bad because it's got saturated fat in it. But actually, most of the fat in meat is the same monounsaturated fat that's in olive oil, oleic acid. So if you actually look at the fat components of meat, you would expect meat to improve your cholesterol profile if you ate it. But because meat contains most of the saturated fat that we eat in our diet, people just said red meat must be bad for you and we should all eat, you know, skinless chicken breasts.
So let me ask you this. Do you have your cholesterol monitored?
I had my cholesterol checked a couple years ago because my wife insisted if I was going to eat the way I eat, I should have life insurance.
And so how do you eat? Give us an example of what you eat for breakfast.
Breakfast, I tend to have bacon and eggs and sausage. I eat a pretty carnivorous diet. I eat a lot of green vegetables and a lot of meat and a lot of cheese. I eat virtually no starches. I don't eat pasta anymore, probably the one thing I miss. You know, we grew up to believe that if you eat, you know, a breakfast of eggs and bacon, it'll kill you quicker than, you know, a 9mm automatic. So, yeah, my wife had me get a life insurance policy, and they have to check your blood, and my cholesterol is fine, and my HDL cholesterol, which is probably the only thing that really matters if you look at the evidence, my HDL was very high. But again, that's only anecdotal evidence. You kind of have to read the book to know if you should believe any of this applies to you.
That was Gary Taubes. He wrote Good Calories, Bad Calories. We'll have a link to it on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. The faithful will often say, Jesus is the reason for the season. But what does that mean in our daily lives? One man set about to find out. He lived for a year as the Bible dictated. And I mean literally. We're talking loaves, fishes, casting stones, and growing a beard. The results of this interesting experiment next, right here on Good Food. Despite the fact that author A.J. Jacobs says he's Jewish in the way that the Olive Garden is Italian, he decided to live 1 year as biblically as possible. Hi, A.J.
Hi, Evan.
Where did you start in terms of all of the food stuff that's in the Bible?
I tried to follow the laws in Leviticus that say no pork, no shellfish, no eagles, no vultures, no
that
ravens.
Must have been hard.
Yeah, that really put a crimp in my diet.
Was eating biblically the same as keeping kosher in the modern world?
It is pretty different. For instance, in the Bible it says that you cannot boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. So if I'm taking the Bible literally, I have to spend a year not boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk, which somehow I was able to do. But the kosher laws say that that is code for something much broader, that you cannot mix milk and meat. So that's where you get all the kosher laws of why you can't have a cheeseburger, for instance. When you really pay attention to what you eat, then it becomes far more than just something you shove in your mouth. It really ties you in with the whole cycle of food.
Now, one of your tasks was to grow a beard. Did you find that you were having secondary meals through your beard?
Oh, I'm afraid I did. There was a buffet in there at the end of several. I won't get into too much detail, but yeah, definitely a problem. Soups, yogurt, big problems.
Now tell me about the concept of peyote and how it connected your beard to your cucumber project.
Well, the Bible talks about how you have to leave the corners of your fields unharvested. This is almost the first welfare system, because poor people in biblical times could come and they could eat the grapes that were in the corner of the field or the wheat. And weirdly, this word, peyot, is also the word that they talk about in the Bible regarding hair, and that you cannot cut the corners of your hair. So it's almost like your head is like a crop, and you're not supposed to cut it, to remind yourself of the poor and those who have less than you. By the end, I had these long sideburns, which you see on Orthodox Jews.
And I understand that your cucumber project, that you tried to create a lot of gleanings because maybe you thought cucumbers would be a bumper crop.
Right, and cucumbers are also in the Bible. That was my attempt to do agriculture, because in the Bible, agriculture is so big. But for some reason, I live in New York, I was in my apartment, and I couldn't get the cucumbers to grow bigger than the size of a Good and Plenty candy. So they were just these hundreds of tiny little cucumbers. So I felt that it wasn't even worth leaving the corners of those for anybody.
Now, one of the things that intrigued me was the fruit you're supposed to eat has to come from trees of a certain age.
That's true. You're not supposed to eat fruit unless the tree itself has been around for at least 4 years, which many people think was a way of instilling patience and discipline.
How did you find out what fruit was around on trees that were older?
Right. Well, this turned out to be a bit of a nightmare, because I kept asking chefs or asking people at the grocery store, do you know if this apple came from a tree that was at least 4 years old? And they would look at me like I was crazy. The best way I could do it was I found out that cherry trees bear fruit very slowly, only in their sixth year, I believe. So I ate a lot of cherries during the year.
I know that in the Bible it says that you're allowed to eat locusts. Did you decide to experiment with bugs?
I did. Yeah, this was one of the odder rules in the Bible. It says you cannot eat any insects except for locusts, grasshoppers, and crickets. So it made a specific loophole for those. And I decided I should take advantage of that. So I did order some crickets. And crunchy, that would be my mostly crunchy. And I will say that that law is interesting, because it makes a little more sense, because back in ancient times, if a plague of locusts ate all of the crops, then there would be nothing left to eat except the locusts themselves.
Now, I don't think we can talk about living biblically without speaking about wine.
Yeah, the Bible seems to indicate that moderate drinking is the key, because if you drink too much, then you get into trouble. Like Noah, for instance. After the flood, he got really, really drunk, and he passed out naked, and his son saw him and made fun of him, and his sons were cursed to eternal slavery. So you don't want to do that.
No, that would be bad.
Right.
So give us the food metaphor that you wrap your book up with.
Food metaphors are such a big part of the Bible. I tried to follow the Bible, the entire Bible, and I could not. I failed. I learned there has to be a certain amount of picking and choosing. And fundamentalists will call this cafeteria religion. So there's the food metaphor. And they use it as a negative phrase. But I say, I've been to some very good cafeterias. So it's all about picking the right dishes, the ones about compassion and tolerance and helping your neighbor, as opposed to the ones about intolerance or violence, which are in the Bible as well.
At the end of all of this, do you still eat cherries? Are you sick of them?
I do still eat them, but not quite as much.
Thank you so much, AJ.
Thanks for having me.
AJ Jacobs is the man behind The Year of Living Biblically. He's an editor-at-large for Esquire magazine. I've got links to more details on his life as a biblican. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to see them. every year hundreds of billions, perhaps even trillions, of little wooden toothpicks are sold worldwide. It's one of those simple tools with a complex history. Henry Petrosky is professor of civil engineering and a professor of history at Duke University. His latest book is The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. So how far back does toothpick use go?
Well, anthropologists believe it goes back about 2 million years.
So were pretty much all early toothpicks made out of wood, out of twigs?
It seems pretty good bet that people, as far back as we can imagine, did just tear a branch off a tree and, you know, take a splinter out of it and use it.
I would imagine that in certain cultures and in certain times, when I think about ancient China or Japan, I think perhaps maybe toothpicks may have been made out of ivory or other objects and were sort of more precious. Is that the case?
Yes, that is the case. For those that could afford those things, it was common to carry around a personal toothpick.
And for people who didn't have the means, did they just whittle their own?
A lot of people did, that's right. Or they might use lesser valued materials such as, say, iron, an iron toothpick, which would effectively be a nail.
Given that people whittled their own, how did the idea of a manufactured product succeed? I would imagine it had to be sold to people, that something that they would have to buy would have more value than something they could just make themselves.
Well, that's right. Back in the 19th century, a lot of things began to be made by machinery. It was really just the natural extension of the Industrial Revolution. And there was a fellow from the New England area named Charles Forster who was working in Brazil, and he noticed that the natives down there were carving toothpicks by hand. And he also noticed that the natives had very white, very clean, decayless teeth. He thought, well, I think that I can make a fortune, literally, if I go back to New England and I begin to make toothpicks by machine and sell them in such a way that I could undersell even these natives in Brazil. But it was not as easy to do as he first thought. So he had to acquire the patent rights to machines that could make toothpicks, and he then had to develop the machinery and figure out exactly what wood was best for toothpicks and so forth. That took him close to about 10 years. When he finally was able to produce toothpicks in such vast quantities, he found that, well, now he had to sell them to people, and not only literally sell them, but also in the sense of marketing them.
Before we get into the marketing, I'm just fascinated by the idea of making a toothpick. My mind tends to go to a cartoon place where you have a tree, and all of a sudden the tree is on a lathe, and what's left of the tree is this one little toothpick.
Well, the beginning is actually correct. It does start as a tree. In fact, white birch, then the bark was taken off the tree, and then it was literally put on a lathe, and it was sort of peeled. A veneer was peeled from around it, and sometimes as long as 100 feet, and then that was fed into a machine that literally chopped off toothpicks the way we might, you know, cut cookies out of cookie dough.
So let's talk about how he marketed this old tool in a new way, because he was pretty ingenious.
Right. Well, you remember in the mid-19th century, just about everybody either had a personal toothpick that they carried around with them, you know, ivory, brass, bronze, whatever, gold even, and silver. So Forster had to figure out a way to break the habits of people and get them accustomed to buying toothpicks that they would then dispose of. What he did is he hired students from Harvard to eat in a restaurant in Boston, and after they enjoyed their meal, they would call for the manager and ask where his wooden toothpicks were. And when the manager said, well, I don't know what you're talking about, they essentially stomped out of the restaurant and said, we'll never come to this establishment again because you don't provide toothpicks for your guests after the meal. Well, of course, the next day, Charles Forster shows up peddling precisely these things that the students had demanded. And naturally, the restaurant manager can't refuse to buy some and distribute to his customers.
Now, what about this custom of sort of walking around with your walking stick and your top hat and having a toothpick in your mouth that you just sort of kept there and moved from side to side and chewed on. Was that an affectation that was marketed as well, or did that just happen naturally?
That seems to have happened naturally. The wooden toothpicks, the machine-made toothpicks, had a texture to them that some people just found pleasurable to chew on them. And very fashionable people would come out of hotels, good restaurants, and stand around on the steps after the meal and just enjoy this postprandial experience of chewing on a toothpick. This happened in the 1870s and 1880s, and these dandies who often had a cane with them came to be known as the Crutch and Toothpick Brigade. They they would walk down the street chewing their toothpicks.
Henry, this has been so much fun. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed it, too.
The Toothpick, Technology and Culture is what history and engineering professor Henry Petrovsky has spent years compiling. I'm really glad he did. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for links to more about the toothpick. Hey, forget home improvement projects. Instead, take up an old school hobby like canning. You might have been inspired lately by the huge number of artisan canned products that you find in the store. We'll talk about some of those and how to look for canning resources. That's coming up on KCRW and KCRW.com. There seems to be an explosion of hobbyists out there making their own preserves who then realize it could be a pretty great little business. So with me here today to talk about how people are preserving like crazy is Rachel Sheridan. She's the buyer for Cube at Divine Pasta. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me back.
I certainly have noticed that whenever I go into any sort of upscale store, even Whole Foods, that it seems like every week there's a new product that's in a jar that looks really appealing and delicious.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time, though, they're made by big companies and, you know, who knows what's in it. Even at Whole Foods these days, I'm a little skeptical. So there's a lot of little companies making these preserves. Rick's Picks just being one of them out of New York, who makes a line of pickles that are to die for.
So it's a guy named Rick?
It is a guy named Rick.
And I noticed, I think, that he has beans. He calls mean beans.
Yes, mean beans. They are a spicy green bean. They're great. They're really good with salumi plates, which is why we love them at Cube. The other cool thing about them is once you're done with the beans, you can actually put your own carrots inside the brine, bottle it up, put it in the fridge, wait 3 days, and then you'll have pickled carrots. They're not shelf stable, so don't leave them on your shelf, but you can definitely do that.
Are most of the artisanal preserves that we're seeing these days that are not fruit, are they shelf stable, or a lot of them showing up just in refrigerator cases?
No, they're mostly shelf stable for up to a year. They've probably been hot packed, I'm guessing, and then probably in boiling water, done for about 10 to 20 minutes, depending on the size of their jar. They're definitely done in the commercial way, but in an artisanal fashion.
What does hot packed mean?
Hot packed means that you're going to cook that food for 3 to 5 minutes in its own brine or in a syrup, then pack it in the jar, and then seal it, and then put it in boiling water. It just really depends, I mean, on the recipe. It's usually about 10 to 15 minutes.
So it's taking hot food, putting it in a jar, so you're packing it while it's hot.
Yeah. You can also do raw fill or cold pack, which means that you would put, say for, this is my mother's very superstitious about this, you put raw cucumbers in a jar, you fill it with hot brine, and then you would do it for the 10 minutes. She thinks it makes
you boil it
crispier
for the 10
pickles.
Minutes.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And I mean, pickles are really that part of the American culture where it seems like everybody's aunt or grandmother has some sort of recipe that's preserved in either vinegar or sugar.
Yes, yeah. It started in France. I mean, it's, and then, you know, they brought it over when they were settlers in America to really preserve the food. I mean, where, you know, in the dead of winter in New England, you really couldn't have any vegetables. So they were putting things up, putting things by. So it really is a great history. We're starting to lose it, which is really sad to me.
I don't know. It seems like it's coming back in a really big way.
I hope so. I really hope so with a lot of these little companies. There's also Happy Girl in Northern Cal, which is great. Lulu's Garden. Also fantastic. She makes some bread and butter pickles that are to die for.
And then there are tons of people working with farmers market fruits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you can do this at home. It's really, really easy. You're not going to give yourself botulism, I promise. It won't happen.
And here I see you brought me all of these fabulous jars.
Yeah,
we have to take a picture of them. But this Tenerelli Indian peach.
Mm-hmm. Those peaches taste like what you think a candy peach tastes like. They're so fragrant. They're not around for very long. I think, what do they have, like a 3 week? They're only around for
window?
3 weeks?
Maybe, yeah.
The same with these. Wong Farm does these desert mangoes, which are awesome. And she only has them for 3 weeks at the farmer's market. So I've made some jam out of those. And these two, I don't use pectin.
Now, what is pectin and what does it do?
Pectin is actually a naturally occurring substance in all fruits. It thickens things. But a lot of fruits just don't have a lot of pectin, so you want to add that. You can get it in powdered form. You can even get it organic from Whole Foods. But really, I don't know. I don't need a jam that's going to, you know, hold its shape and form. This apple butter, this is actually from my hometown, Vianna, Ohio.
I think applesauce and apple butter is the easiest entry point to preserving, because it's you take apples, you peel them, you seed them, you put them in a pot with a tiny bit of water so nothing burns.
Your house smells wonderful.
And you cook it.
Yeah, and you just cook it all day. And you just add whatever spices, or don't. A lot of people like to make like a naked applesauce, and then you can just do with it what you will when you're ready. I do a really great braised pork butt with some naked applesauce. And then you can add whatever. If you want to add shallots, you add shallots. But you've always got it ready. And you know what's in it, which is the most important thing to me.
When she's not canning, Rachel Sheridan is the food buyer at Cube on La Brea. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for canning resources. Hey, let's meet on Facebook. You can become a fan of me, Evan Kleiman, right there. Also, did you know that you can embed this show on your blog or webpage? Go to the kcrw.com/goodfood site and click listen. Watch the latest videocast there too and comment on the Good Food blog. We really want to hear from you. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Van Challener, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Thanks to Karen Soriano and Gary Messiha. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.